Welcome, everybody, to the next edition for our speaker series. This is John Patika Jr. with the Patika Wealth Management Group here in Clearwater, Florida. And I'm here with our senior partner, John Patika Sr. And he's been recognized by Forbes magazine as one of the top wealth managers in the state of Florida. And we have a really timely subject today about energy. And we're all feeling it at the pump right now. And we have one of the best analysts on the street, Jay Dobson, joining us. And Jay joined UBS in 2016. He's got over 30 years of investment experience, primarily as an equity research analyst in utilities and just about all things energy. He's also been a former member of the Department of Energy's Electricity Advisory Board to the U.S. Energy Secretary. So, Jay, welcome to the call.
Hey, thanks, John. I really appreciate it. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we hear you good.
Loud and clear, Jay.
Great.
Hey, Jay, thanks for coming on. We'll get right to it. I know we try to keep things around a half hour, so let's get right to it. Obviously, oil and energy prices are up and running, and it seems like Europe's engaged in some real self-destructive behavior in the past as far as energy goes. As our buddy Art Cashin always says, low tide exposes the naked swimmers, and it seems that there's quite a few in Europe. What do they do? How is this Russian attack going to shake out and all the ancillary things that go with it?
Yeah, John, it's a really, really good question. I mean, to set the stage a little bit, it's important to take a step back, or sometimes I say a step up to a slightly higher level. I mean, we have to keep in mind that, you know, crude oil is probably a good measure of global energy has been really, really tight for sort of the last 9+ months. And when I say tight, I mean sort of the supply-demand balance for crude oil. I mean, crude oil as a global physical commodity, though we don't have perfect transparency on demand or, quite frankly, inventories, you know, when supply exceeds demand for even a short period of time, we see inventories grow. And again, we can't see all inventories. We can't see inventories in China, but we can certainly see inventories in the developed world. In periods where demand exceeds supply, we see inventories, what we call draw or decline. And we've been watching inventories draw for a little over 9 months now. Now, again, keep in mind, don't need probably to remind anybody, certainly not myself, that we've been, you know, in a pandemic now for 2 years. You know, we can look back and say, you know, oil prices got to, on a forward basis, you know, less than $0 in May of 2020. So OPEC pulled back a bunch of supply. Since then, we've seen demand recovering. We've seen supply coming back. OPEC's continuing to increase supply somewhat slowly. U.S. producers are raising supply. And yet, despite all that, you know, we've been in a modestly undersupplied market. So you sort of have to keep that in mind when we start asking the question, what does this Russian aggression mean? You know, really, at a very high level, it just makes that tight market tighter. And that's why we're seeing crude oil, you know, react the way it is. You know, Russia is the third largest producer of crude oil globally, the second largest exporter. They also, obviously, to your question on Europe, are a very large exporter of natural gas to Europe. So I think the real issue here is, first, a tight market just got tighter given geopolitical events. B, or second, as you pointed out, you know, places like Europe and a few others, you know, have been racing really, really hard towards renewables without a real focus, in our opinion, on energy security. And, you know, hopefully we'll have an opportunity to talk about, you know, sort of how that balance or the calculus of the transition works. But I think the reality is, to your point, you know, when the tide goes out, we show sort of what people are made of. And I think in places like Europe, it's going to be a pretty tough environment. Clearly, we're going out of the winter heating season. And so you'll see seasonal declines in demand for natural gas. But it's still really important what's going to happen because, you know, we all pay attention to the news. And, you know, many of us saw the U.S. sanctioned you know, Russian crude, natural gas, and coal. Canada has sanctioned oil from Russia. UK has. Australia has done the same. But what's been more important, or perhaps more interesting to us as observers of that physical market, has been people self-sanctioning. So companies have been refusing to buy oil from Russia. You know, it was only a week ago today that we thought we were getting an interesting data point. You know, Shell, about this time last Friday, was announcing that they had just bought a cargo of Russian crude from a large commodity broker, Trafigura. Within 8 hours of them purchasing that, they were apologizing publicly for having bought it. So what we're seeing is, notwithstanding people in Europe aren't, governments aren't sanctioning European crude, we're seeing buyers sanction. And that's what's making that market really tight. So I'm sorry for the long answer, but I did want to sort of set the table there, because hopefully it'll help when I'm answering other questions. But, you know, the market's really tight, and places like Europe that are, you know, significant net importers of energy are going to feel the squeeze as prices rise.
That's why we have you on there. You answer complete answers, and we'll worry about the half hour. Hey, we're in the investment business, Jay. Stock prices are up. What should we do now? And then you have the subsectors, you know, pipelines, LNG terminals. Where should we go? What should we do?
Yeah, great question. It sort of brings it all home. You know, we in UBS Chief Investment Office, we've been overweight energy for a little over a year now. It's been a great call, obviously. The sector outperformed last year. It's outperforming this year, you know, holding the rather unique moniker as being the only sector up year to date. So, you know, when we feel like or wonder why we were overweight, it was the fundamental tightness in the market that we saw, that imbalance between rising demand and rising supply, but more slowly rising supply, which is going to drive prices higher. So we remain overweight. I'll admit, look, it does not look as attractive as it did, but I would say, you know, I would remain overweight right now and just look at opportunities to maybe protect my gains. You know, John, you and your team, I know, can, you know, look at some put option strategies and others to protect gains, maybe taking a little money off the table. So I would be thinking about those strategies, but you know, I would keep in mind right now, just to put a real fine point on it, you know, our forecast for June WTI crude is $122 a barrel. And if I'm losing sleep over anything right now, I worry that that price is too low and needs to go higher. There's a lot of calculus in that that goes, where is supply going to come from? Are we going to cut a deal with Iran? Are we going to cut a deal with Venezuela? You know, are people going to start lifting these Russian barrels? But I worry that prices yet have to go higher. And if prices, oil prices are going higher, you know, energy stocks are going to do better. They may not move in absolute lockstep with that oil price, but a rising oil price will also negatively impact the broader market. So by remaining overweight energy right now, even with my little bit of concern that, you know, energy stocks have run far already, I buy a geopolitical hedge, an inflation hedge, and yes, oh, by the way, a hedge to higher oil prices. So we're still overweight within the subsectors. As you point out, you know, we've liked the exploration and production, the U.S. onshore companies, along with the integrated companies, you know, like Exxon. You know, the refiners struggle in a rising crude oil price environment, you know, largely because they're buying that crude. You know, crude oil is their input cost. So, you know, they have to struggle past that. I still like the refiners, but you do have to be careful. I like them because of rising margins. And quite frankly, the oil field services companies, you know, if we are in this energy crunch that is going to last for multiple years, we are going to find a way to be spending more money with companies like Schlumberger, Halliburton, and Baker Hughes. The pipelines, you know, they have relative stability in this sort of environment. So they're going to underperform the upstreams and the integrateds, but these companies are in much better shape. So I would use them as a part of an energy portfolio, you know, really sort of being neutral weight the pipes and overweight, you know, oil field services, upstream companies, E&Ps, and integrated oil companies.
Jay, price for oil, let's just talk about what is the possible upside. I know there's a you guys did some work on where people start changing their habits and behaviors. In a bad scenario, this thing takes a long time and it gets bad. What's the upside price for oil before people start, you know, making habits to change their usage? And then what would be the downside? Where are we in trouble if they get this thing fixed over the weekend?
Yeah, great question. I mean, you know, it's art trying to decide, particularly on a global basis, where demand destruction begins, because it's not a linear function, and it's also not a single number. You know, I would argue in places like India, you know, probably that $125 is already beginning to destroy demand. We think a price is probably needs to be higher than that, probably closer to $150 to really get, you know, sort of global demand destruction. But by its very nature, at $150, you'd probably see whatever little supply response you have and demand destruction to, you know, sort of have that upside price probably not last that long. You know, I'd hate to say days, but it strikes me that something like weeks would be hard to sit it at a 150 level unless something, you know, really surprising is happening on supply. But, you know, I will say the caveat I'd offer there is if people refuse to buy Russian crude, you know, Scott Sheffield at Pioneer has said if all of their exports are denied a buyer, you could see something 150 to 200. That's not how we're feeling about it, but we also believe people like China and India will ultimately step in to buy those Russian crude barrels. To the downside, I think particularly once you assume that a geopolitical premium in crude is here to stay, I sort of feel like you could fall back to the $90 level. But unless you have like the perfect storm, we have a deal with Iran, we have some deal with Venezuela, you know, OPEC maybe starts splintering a little bit and is bringing back more supply. I think there you could end, you know, hostilities end to bring those Russian barrels fully back. I mean, it strikes me that some Russian barrels are going to struggle to find a home for an extended period of time. So I struggle to think that downside would exist. But in that perfect scenario, you know, you could certainly see something, you know, in the closer to $75 or $80. I don't think, again, in a period where demand is rising. I guess, again, the only caveat I'd offer to that is the underlying assumption there is, you know, we're not in a global recession. Europe will be more impacted by that. So the longer prices stay high, the greater the likelihood that the European Union's falling into recession. I think it's harder to see that in the U.S., never impossible, but harder to see that in the U.S. just given the strength of growth, but certainly something we're looking at. So I'd say right now in sort of a scenario, even if it's slow, of global economic growth, I would sort of say 150 plus on the upside and maybe 75, 80 on the downside.
Okay. And the other side, you hear a lot of, I think, misinformation. I believe that we're at probably about 60% of the rig count number in North America that we were pre-COVID, and that you can get the fracking wells on quick, and that these guys opened up their best fracking wells first. But if the government would just say, hey, let's do it, you know, make some kind of compromise. How fast can they get these wells back up, or are they not going to do the last, if I'm right on that number, 40%?
Yeah, I would say you could see a little bit of growth in the rig count, but probably not a lot. You know, there's a couple of variables. You know, you can't really compare, you know, rig count now to, you know, rig count 6 or 7 years ago, largely because the productivity of a rig has gone up pretty dramatically. So you're getting more production out of a single rig, just the way they're putting it to work. But I think as well, you have a shortage of rigs, shortage of labor. I mean, I think when you went through the downturn 7 years, you know, the Halliburtons, the Schlumbergers, they stacked a lot of equipment, and some of that older equipment ultimately got retired. And even I was on a Goldman Sachs call just earlier this week with the CEO of Halliburton, and, you know, his point was, you know, this is a cash flow and margin cycle, not an investment cycle. So I even think the services companies probably aren't really excited about going out and expanding capacity. So I think we could raise some supply at the margin. You know, remember, U.S. producers are already, you know, on track to raise production by about 5%. It might be a little higher than that. It probably depends a bit on where exactly inflation turns out, but I think it'd probably be 5%. It varies. Privates are probably running higher single digits. Some of the publics are running slightly lower single digits, but I'd say it's right about 5%. So it's not right when you see people talking heads in Washington saying U.S. producers aren't growing. It's just, can they grow faster? I think the U.S. producers are really looking at OPEC's raising supply. Do I want to raise supply while OPEC's doing it? You know, U.S. government's negotiating with Iran, and I don't know what's going to happen there. Do I want to raise supply while that is? And, you know, again, just very lately, you know, the U.S. administration's been talking to Venezuela bringing back. So since, you know, a well payback is going to be, you know, 5 to 7 years, not next week, I think U.S. producers are being very disciplined and I think very responsible in looking at, you know, ways they can to manage their business well, notwithstanding you know, very public outcry in a short period of time, given very, very high oil prices. I mean, the other thing I'd point out, which isn't as visible to, you know, people who sort of look at just a spot price for oil, the forward curve for oil is dramatically backwardated. So even if you were saying, hey, what is the forward curve for crude telling me about, you know, prices in the future for oil, it would tell you that 2 years out, prices are $70. And you know, though I don't think prices can stay at 110 or 120, you know, I would also say the other side of that is I don't think prices 2 or 3 years from now are going to be $70.
Kind of a side question. I know the Alaska pipeline's putting through about 500 barrels a day now. There's the potential to add to that from ANWR and all that. Can you talk about the Alaskan pipeline for a minute?
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, just like any other supply in the U.S., you don't just sort of turn a spigot and all of a sudden that oil starts flowing. So people like ConocoPhillips and others are looking at developing additional resources up in Alaska. But, you know, those would take, you know, a couple of years to bring online. You really, John, we're talking, you know, some of the shale resources. And look, I think if you put more rigs to work in the Permian, you know, you are probably talking, you know, 3 to 6 months from, you know, sort of spud to first oil. But I would say, you know, on average up in Alaska, it's going to take longer than that because most of those are pretty traditional resources. So again, everybody at these levels, no one is incented. If you have fast action, low cost, you know, reserves that are sitting there on the shelf, I mean, the price is telling you, you know, go take it. It's really just when you say, well, it's not actually right there on the shelf. I've either got to invest a lot of money or, you know, I've got to take a lot of time to bring it, that the decision becomes, I think, more complicated.
Now, LNG is a big deal. I know, you know, we watched the Cheniere thing and the Dominion do that. There's apparently 6 new LNG export terminals being held up, multi-billion dollar projects. Can you talk about that? And I guess they've been held up for more than a year.
Yeah, these things take a lot of time. And I mean, again, I'll always be critical of the government because I think whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you know, the government does tend to move more slowly than they should. I would say there isn't one LNG facility that I'm aware of that is fully contracted and simply awaiting permits. So I do think it's a little unfair when the media says, hey, you know, they don't have the permits. They don't have the permits, but they're not pushing as fast as they would otherwise because they actually don't have the contracts. And, you know, Exxon or Chevron, a company of that scale, will build an LNG facility on spec. They don't generally, because think of an LNG facility. Before you even bought the gas, the facility itself costs $2.5 billion. So, and it takes you about 2 years to build it, 18 months if you're moving fast. So, you know, these are really capital intensive projects. The way you tend to see them is you get, whether it's a European or an Asian buyer, to contract you up for 10 or 15 years, then you use those contracts to go finance the building of the LNG facility. So I'm not aware of any, in fact, I know it, there's no facility that has the contract as a waiting permit, but I do think the government will move quicker on that. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has put some, you know, new environmental oversight to make sure these are being sited in the right places. But again, right places, these things have to be on the water. They've got to be in and around the Gulf Coast or, you know, Mexico. So, you know, there's a limited number of places you can really put them. But yeah, there's going to be more of that. You just have to recognize they're really, really capital intensive. And I've been around this business for 30 years to know that really capital intensive projects tend to have a lot more risk than people anticipate.
A couple of quick questions. Russian oil imports to the United States, my belief it's 600,000 barrels a day. I don't know if that's an accurate. What are your thoughts on that? And can it be replaced or is it even true? Where is it coming in the Northeast?
It's really small. Of pure crude, it's about 200,000 barrels a day. Of, you know, crude and refined products, it's about 700,000. So you can see about 450, 460,000 of refined products, gasoline, diesel, et cetera. And yeah, very replaceable. The Russian crude, their Urals grade, looks a lot like the Mars grade that comes out of the Gulf of Mexico or Saudi Arabian light that comes out of Saudi Arabia. So it's replaceable. I think the key issue is, you know, making sure that supply is available. Luckily, as I said, it's not a big piece of the U.S. supply, but I do think at the margin, you have to think particularly on the refined product side. And this is why we like names like Phillips 66 and Marathon, notwithstanding the higher oil price environment, is that, you know, refiners are going to have an opportunity to sort of continue to operate more and maintain their margins. And oh, by the way, they've got an advantaged margin given their lower energy prices here in the U.S., you know, relative to refiners in Europe. So I do think we'll be able to offset that. And that's not that big a deal.
Another one is, I know we're running around the world talking to Iran and Venezuela and Saudi Arabia. How much, if the Russian, I don't know, I guess they're exporting 5 million barrels a day, correct me if I'm wrong, but how much can any one of those replace if they come online and how fast?
Yeah, great question. So Russia exports just approaching 4 million barrels a day of pure crude. Obviously, products is on top of that. So if you saw all their exports, it'd be about 7. But of pure crude, it's almost 4. So then we say, let's assume for a moment, all that's gone. So something approaching, let's call it 3.5 is gone and needs to be replaced. You know, Iran would be 1 or 1.2 million barrels a day. About half of that could come really fast as soon as U.S. takes sanctions off of them. The other half would probably take 6 months or so. Saudi Arabia has a similar amount, about 1 million to 1.5 million. They claim it could come pretty fast. Our assumptions is it might take, you know, 3-6 months and would, you know, sort of scale up. Venezuela is probably the weakest of all those. Not only has there been a lack of investment, but there's been a lack of maintenance in those facilities. So you could probably get maybe 300 or 400,000 barrels a day out of Venezuela if all sanctions were taken off. So the key is you probably can't fill that 3.5 with those three. Now, I think you could, and I think this would take more than a year. You know, the U.S. in 2019 produced almost 13 million barrels a day. Last year, we were at 11.2. This year, we'll probably be in and around 11.8 or 11.9. So you could say, well, the U.S. probably could increase another million barrels. But again, I think that would take another year. So, you know, your question's a really good one. You know, if we did, and again, I don't think you could see all the Russian barrels backing out because, you know, for better or for worse, history tells us China will step in to lift those cargoes eventually. India will do the same. So, yeah, I don't think you would require to replace all of them, but some of them. And there's not a lot of great answers for that.
Jay, you cover utilities also. Why don't you comment on utilities? Go any direction you want.
Yeah, I mean, look, utilities essentially are really, really stable, mature businesses. So, you know, fundamentals are fine in utility. In a period of accelerating economic growth, utilities tend to lag the market. And we saw that. We've had an underweight on utilities. It worked really well last year. We probably should have pulled it off if I'd have been smart enough to see this aggression in Ukraine coming. We're still underweight. I wish we weren't underweight. But you know, unless we're moving into recession, probably the best move in utilities is behind us. I think the place, whether it's a neutral weight or an underweight in a diversified equity portfolio, the way you want to think of utilities is, you know, stability, and then sort of this longer term objective of playing the renewable and energy transition theme. I mean, you know, the energy transition theme, you know, includes utilities, it includes, you know, wind and solar pure plays, but I would argue it also includes, you know, sort of the oil and gas companies, because, you know, we've taken for the last 2 years, and, you know, it was pretty unpopular when we originally started saying it, you know, we really believe energy transition requires an all of the above approach, where it isn't, you know, solar and wind or natural gas, it's solar and wind and natural gas and oil and batteries and hydrogen and carbon capture. So you need all of these things together. I think the utilities are sort of fast first movers because they're sort of the easiest sector to reduce the carbon footprint of. Taking coal out of the mix, replacing that with gas cuts the carbon emissions in half, at the margin adding wind and solar. You know, we like names like American Electric Power and NextEra in that plight. You know, really, really good, well-run companies that are very well positioned to play both that stable business piece that we talked about originally, but as well this energy transition and the deployment of utility scale wind and solar to take advantage of the very, very low costs of wind and solar resources.
Just a couple more questions, Jay. Tell me what you know. I know you can't do that. It'll take forever. But about modern nuclear power. I mean, there's such a misnomer over that. Is that a direction we need to go? It looks like the French are building more, and all of a sudden the Germans might not be shutting down every last plant.
Yeah, it's an interesting question we've thought a lot of late. I think in Europe and in the U.S., it's pretty hard to see a lot of additional nuclear being built. The best case is, as you're pointing out, we're going to operate existing nuclear longer, more safely, but longer than we might have expected. Where you're seeing new nuclear built actually is in Asia. And there, you know, quite frankly, given labor and, you know, some of their designs, they have a cheaper footprint. The problem in Europe and the US is, you know, nuclear is really expensive. We're seeing this in Georgia, where Southern Company's building a new nuclear plant. It's sort of 100% over budget. It's 2 years behind schedule. These things tend to be really, really difficult and expensive to build. So I've been a fan of nuclear for a very, very long time, and I remain a fan philosophically. It's just economically, I think we need some new breakthroughs. Now, there is some exciting breakthroughs, small modular nuclear, essentially a really small nuclear plant that is built in a factory, sort of the way they build tractors or other industrial machinery, and then it's brought out and plopped on the ground. That holds some promise, but that's probably, you know, 8-10 years away. There are some new nuclear, what we call fourth generation plants that are under development, but similar, they're probably about 10 years away. So I feel like we've got a lot to do on wind and solar in the interim. I hope nuclear is a part of the answer. I really believe a couple of decades from now, it definitely will be, but in the near term, call it the next, you know, 2 to 7 years, it's hard outside of Asia to see it going very far.
Yeah, I saw a Netflix special on Bill Gates' brain, and they were talking about how he gathered all the nuclear engineers together and created some modern plant that, to me, it looked pretty interesting. I don't know if you saw
That's TerraPower. It's a private company. But yeah, that's the small modular nuclear that I was talking about. Yep, exactly. There's them. There's NuScale. There's a couple of private entities are trying to do that, but they won't have, you know, sort of regulatory approval for those plants probably until 2029 or 2030.
Last question. I know we're running a little beyond, but look, we all know oil prices have gone up. The stocks have gone up. I'm in the investment business. What do I do?
Yeah, as I said, I would maintain that overweight, understanding that, you know, they've done really, really well, and maybe think about hedging a little of our gains. I would maintain the overweight, recognizing, you know, geopolitics are very complicated. Inflation continues to be a challenge. And oh, by the way, our worry is risks to oil prices are the upside. You know, our favorite ideas in pure energy would be ConocoPhillips, Pioneer Natural Resources. And then just because we think the refiners are interested, Phillips 66 on the refiner side.
Anything with like Schlumberger or Baker Hughes? Any thoughts on those that you can say?
Yeah, we like Schlumberger. You know, we're more neutral on Baker, but I would say that any of those names, you know, particularly if we get a little bit of pullback in them, would be interesting names. But, you know, Schlumberger has been sort of the way we've been choosing to play that Exxon in the large integrated.
Great. Well, thanks, Jay. I know we're running low on time here. Really appreciate it. And if anyone on the call would like any of Jay's material or publications, feel free to reach out to the team. We'd be more than happy to send it over to you. And Jay, before we close out, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I would just love to say thank you to the whole Patika team. I mean, you know, we're here in CIO, a resource dedicated to you guys. So please, if anybody on the phone has any other questions, don't hesitate to reach out to the team. I'd be happy to re-engage and get you whatever answers to questions you have. But thank you so much for everyone's time. Time is not what we all have a lot of, so I appreciate you dedicating a bit of it to hear what we have to say on the energy stuff. Thanks, John.
All right, everyone. Everyone, take care. That concludes our call. And remember, the replay of this call will be on our website and on Spotify, so feel free to listen to the replay there. Everyone, take care and have a great weekend.
Neither UBS Financial Services, Inc., nor any of its employees provide tax or legal advice. You should consult with your personal tax or legal advisor regarding your personal circumstances. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokered services in its capacity as a SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokered services are separate and distinct, different in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that clients understand the ways in which we conduct business and to carefully read the agreements and disclosures we provide them about the products and services we offer. For more information, please review the following PDF document, ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG, member of FINRA, member of SIPC. This information is being provided to you for the following information purposes only and does not constitute a recommendation or endorsement by UBS Financial Services, Inc., nor the author of the securities reviewed stated herein. Any specific securities discussion should not be considered a recommendation or a solicitation to buy or sell any particular security. You should not assume that any investment in any of the securities was or will be profitable. Forbes Best in State Wealth Advisors list is comprised of approximately 5,000 financial advisors. It was developed by Shook Research and is based on an in-person and telephone due diligence meetings to measure factors such as quality of practice, industry experience, compliance record, assets under management, which vary from state to state, and revenue. Although neither UBS Financial Services, Inc. or its employees pay a fee in exchange for these ratings, UBS may hire RJ Shook to be a speaker for events. Past performance is not an indication of future results. Investment performance is not a criterion because client objectives and risk tolerances vary, and advisors rarely have audited performance reports. Rankings are based on the opinions of Shook Research, LLC, and are not indicative of future performance or representative of any one client's experience.